Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Immediately the rumours started.
The mysterious death of a legendary sports star.
There's this massive landslide of myth.
Legend of Tahti.
And somewhere in there is the truth.
Part of Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Picture the scene. Plainclothes police swarm over a blood-spattered alleyway sealed off with striped tape. Next, the action moves to a pristine, white-walled laboratory filled with white-coated technicians. Then it's onto a wood-panelled courtroom with the eyes of a jury fixed on a smartly dressed scientific expert. Of course, this is how we often see the process of forensic science imagined in books and on TV. It's also depicted as black and white, as right versus wrong, guilty or not guilty. But as we know, science is more often about shades of grey. It's about uncertainty and the things we don't know rather than what we do. So what happens when these two very different worlds collide, the world of science and the law? As my guest today will testify, the reality can be difficult and often fraught. And in some, thankfully rare cases, there can be grave mistakes. Dr. Sheila Willis is a forensic scientist who was Director General of Forensic Science Ireland for many years. The advancements in technology she's seen during her career have been astounding. But, says Dr. Willis, at the very heart of forensics is fundamental science, clarity of mind and the ability to ask the right questions. Today we're going to find out all about the cold, hard facts of forensic science, and we'll be turning the studio into a crime scene to find out if I would be any good at it. Dr. Sheila Willis, welcome to The Life Scientific.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Now, Sheila, your career in forensics has spanned more than four decades, so I'm going to test your memory now. Do you recall your very first case?
I remember the first case on which I gave evidence very well. Because even though I didn't realise it at the time, it was a bit of a baptism of fire. And it was an unusual case in many ways. It was the murder of Lord Mountbatten and members of his family. Wow. And the local boy. He used to holiday in Sligo, in Classybond Castle, and went out in a boat, the Shadow Five, where a bomb exploded when the boat was just out from the coast. The unusual part about this case was that the Irish police force, the Gardaí, had actually taken the suspects into custody before the bomb exploded because they were suspicious of the activity of the guys when they stopped them in a car. And that actually meant that the clothing of the suspects were in the forensic science laboratory before the scene was even examined. And I think that's the only example I can think of where that happened. I was with colleagues examining the clothing and recovered a number of flakes of multi-layer green paint. And then the items from the scene came in, and hey presto, after analysing and examining and so on, we had matches.
Mm.
And there were also smears of paint on the clothing.
And that green paint was crucial, wasn't it, for the conviction? But you were rather unimpressed by a request from the judge.
The judge asked me, would I smear some green paint that I had dried onto a slide onto my jacket? And my immediate reaction was, I'd rather not, my lord. That was the only jacket I had. And the last thing I wanted was that I was going to have a big smear of green paint on it. So the judge actually took the slide and smeared it on his own.
On his own, okay.
And I think that was probably critical enough, because the judge needed to convince himself that a dried paint surface would smear.
Yeah. Now, listeners may know that after you finished your analysis in the lab, you have to write a report that goes to the police. But then you might be asked to present your findings at a trial, like you did with this one. In fact, I looked this up. Back in Roman times, the word forensic, I'm sure you know this, comes from the Latin forensis, meaning of the forum, where public meetings, criminal trials were held. So, you know, it's a place where you had to debate and had to defend your work. Now, most scientists will present their work at scientific conferences. What's it like to have to do it in a court of law instead?
Well, I'm delighted that you looked up what the origin of the word is, because I sometimes use the slide of the forum in Rome as an introduction to forensic science. And I hate the fact that we've now evolved into talking about forensics, which I think is a meaningless word. But the court is certainly a very different arena from the scientific conference, mainly because the adversarial system is designed in such a way as to, you know, undermine your opponent. That's right. That's the nature of the game. The outsider or the layperson will say, but you just to go in and report your findings. And to some extent, that's true. But you want to make sure that your findings get a reasonable level of understanding, that they fit in and that they're not completely rubbished or that they're not overemphasised. And that's more difficult than it might seem.
And you say the process reminds you a bit of food packaging.
I feel we have a tendency in the modern world to say that everybody has to have all information. And food packaging is the example that strikes me. So it's almost as though the more information we give, the less the message is clear.
As I alluded to in my introduction, there must be a real clash of cultures between science and the law, because they are very different worlds, aren't they?
They're very different worlds. I mean, although originally, when you were going back to Roman times, originally I think law was considered a science, if you think of it as being a discipline of work. But in the legal world, there's a need to come to a final decision. It's guilty or not guilty. That's the desire. Whereas, as we both know, in science, it's, and as I was said in the introduction there, it's a continuum of uncertainties. And the real role is, can we identify the level of uncertainty? Mm-hmm. And yet, I've felt throughout my career a drive from the law to expect yes and no, black and white. It either is or it isn't. And it's one of the things that I've often had put to me by the defence barrister, you know, saying, well, you know, what are you saying? It is or it isn't? And really the answer very often is it depends. And that makes it difficult as well in how to communicate the value of what you're doing.
I've always said in science, you know, we value uncertainty, that we can never be absolutely sure about something. We always have to be open to changing our minds, proving that we're wrong. And just how different that is from the law.
Exactly. And the very fact, the very word uncertain, which has a meaning and a value in science, really has a kind of a pejorative inference in other areas.
Right, yes.
I don't think science is ever going to be the definitive answer in the courtroom. I mean, forensic science is a supportive part of the criminal trial.
And how does it feel when a case, like the Mountbatten one, is over and there's a conviction, which is to a large part thanks to your work?
You know, I'd be not being truthful if I said that it didn't matter. And it's not supposed to matter. You know, your science is meant to be above what happens in the court and so on. But, you know, you're a human being and there's a feeling that you've been of some value if your work has contributed in some way.
Is that why you do your job?
I knew that as soon as I started in forensic science that I really enjoyed it. And it's been, you know, a life of learning. But I couldn't make myself out to be a very altruistic individual that's saving the world.
Right, right. Well, Sheila Willis, we'll come back to the science in a bit, but let's go back to the beginning. Tell me where you were born.
I was born in Wexford town in the southeast of Ireland. And I think it's traditional, you know, for people of my age to look back and think of an idyllic childhood. But I pretty well had an idyllic childhood. I spent a lot of time at the seaside because I had a cousin the same age. And we wandered off for hours on end. Nobody knew where we were or what we were doing. So it was a very different era from the one we have today.
Your father was an electrician, and I gather very much into understanding how the world works. So a big influence on you and your love of science. But it was actually at school, I gather, when you were about 10, that you first heard the word science.
I was absolutely devastated because my best friend at the time was going to another school to encourage her beautiful singing voice, and there was no hope that that was going to happen to me. And in my kind of anxiety, the teacher was reassuring me and said, but you know, you'll be a scientist. I have no idea why she said that. although I would have been interested. She had given us pamphlets to read, and I remember the two. One was on how the blood moves around the body and the other was the composition of air. And I was really excited to find out things like that.
So when did you first figure out science might be the path you want to take?
I had a particular teacher, Sister Eukaria, who I had great admiration for. And she helped me to do chemistry as an additional subject.
Chemistry wasn't on the curriculum?
Chemistry wasn't on the curriculum.
Right.
I think at home there would have been a bit of tension. My mother would have been keen for, you know, a job that brought me back home, like a primary teacher or something. And my father was quite encouraging about the idea of university. And once it was university, there was no question but that it was science. I mean, I don't remember it being a decision. It was science.
That just happened.
Yeah,
because you did end up going to a University College Dublin, studying science, where you seem to have enjoyed student life, but I believe you found it quite hard academically at first.
Essentially, you know, I was top of the tree in school in Wexford. And then I went into an environment where not only was I not top of the tree, but like I was amongst so many very bright individuals. But I loved the environment. I absolutely loved being in university. I joined the mountaineering club. I met my husband. I have friends from that time that are friends to this day. It was a wonderful time.
I mean, you have a smile on your face. You clearly have fond memories. But as you say, initially, it must have been a culture shock for you.
Well, I can remember when I came to Dublin, I didn't know what side the road the buses travelled on. I had no companion coming with me that or no experience to tell me what to expect. I would say it was the biggest, you know, most people make lots of changes throughout their lives. I think that move from Wexford to Dublin, even though it's 100 miles up the road is all that it is, it was probably the biggest cultural change in my life, really.
You have a rather evocative memory from your first year.
Yes, I had an opportunity to come to London for what was Youth Science Fortnight. So young people from all over the world gathered. It was a really exciting experience. And I remember a few things from it. I remember seeing the structure of ferrocene for the first time.
Which is?
It's the first of the sandwich compounds that was discovered. So there's an iron molecule sandwiched between two five-membered rings. And it looked completely different from anything I had seen to then. And actually it was relatively new. I think it was only about 20 years before that it had been discovered. And hindsight's wonderful in the way it works on your memory. It maybe that's why I remember it, because I ended up then working in transition metal chemistry for my fourth year project and eventually for my PhD.
You can trace back that interest in that chemical.
I still think it's a very elegant looking compound. And
well, you stayed on then in Dublin for your PhD in chemistry. And it's during that time you met your husband, John Fox, a fellow chemistry student at the time. But your plans to marry, this is in the summer of 1977, nearly scuppered your first job at a paper mill.
I wanted an opportunity maybe to use the training I'd had in research chemistry. But I was thinking, you know, this was 1977. Would a woman chemist get a job? Hmm. And specifically, would a married woman chemist get a job?
At the time, the law in Ireland, I gather, was that if a woman was getting married...
Up to 1974,
right.
A married woman in the public service had to give up work when they got married.
When they got married.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. So that was only 3 years later. So I was going along to the interview and I think, OK, I can't say I'm getting married and I can't say how I travelled here. I have no idea why I thought it was odd to come on a motorbike, but anyway. The interviewer asked me, so how did you get here? And I said, I came on the motorbike. I didn't say that I had hidden the helmet in a hedge, but I did say I came on the motorbike. And then I thought, oh, this is going okay. So I said, and I'm getting married in July.
You volunteered the information that you've promised yourself you wouldn't.
Yeah, yeah. And he still took me on.
And you did get married. You later had two daughters, Niamh and Orla. Now, usually at this point, my guests on the programme tell me about how their children wanted nothing to do with science and went off to do something completely different with their lives. But I gather yours bucked that trend.
Both our daughters are scientists. Niamh's a chemist and Orla's a biologist. I think back with some embarrassment about our daughter turning to her dad and saying, and what was the mass spec like today? I wonder why the poor unfortunate children became scientists.
Well, in 1979, Sheila, you saw an intriguing job advert as a forensic scientist for Ireland's Ministry of Justice, which you applied for and you got. What was it that attracted you to that particular job?
Here was an ad with a list of fantastic range of analytical instruments. And I thought, oh, you know, that's something I should have a look at. You felt you were doing something that was of some value. You know, you were definitely using the science, but it had some application and some value.
Yeah.
Plus the fact that it was very early days, you know, it was kind of making things up as you went along. I mean, we didn't make them up, but you know what I mean, that you were establishing norms and finding out how things worked. Mm. It was an exciting time.
OK, it's probably time for us to dig a little into how forensic science works. So let's picture this radio studio as the scene of a break-in. When you first entered this room, what are you looking for?
Well, you give me your impression first as to what you'd expect.
Oh, OK. I suppose fingerprints on smooth surfaces, maybe the odd stray strand of hair on this chair, maybe some evidence of an overzealous life scientific fan. Is that the sort of thing?
Well, it's not hugely wrong. But I would first start with saying, what are we imagining happened here? We then try to look for traces that might support that or not. So if the glass was broken, we'd look for fragments of glass. If something was taken, we'd look around that area for fingerprints, as you mentioned, also DNA, because there's the possibility of DNA being shed. And it's also completely context dependent. Because supposing somebody had heard a rumour, well, you know, Jim was actually going to set up in his bedroom and he needed some of the equipment.
Uh-huh.
Well, then, whether it be hair or DNA or fingerprints, there isn't a lot of point in looking for any of them.
Because I'm here normally.
Exactly.
Legally.
Exactly. So we'd move to digital traces, maybe even track your movements via your phone or find whether or not you were in here at unusual times.
And if you're picking up bits of evidence like DNA, strands of hair and so on, what kind of test do you then do in the lab?
There are multiple stages that are involved in the process. The microscope used to be the symbol of forensic science. I don't think it is so much now. I think it's DNA. But the first thing would be to look through things under the microscope and isolate the bits that you were going to look at further. And the analysis might be, well, the comparison microscope was a tool of choice where you looked at two items on two separate microscopes through the same ocular so that you saw whether or not they looked the same. Then there was the possibility of carrying out infrared analysis to see what the composition was. Or one that I rather liked, even though it was really low tech, was the reaction to different solvents. You just have little inkwells and put items under the microscope and show a reaction to a number of different solvents.
That's
and you
right.
get check whether or not things were the same. They're all designed to address a particular question at a particular time in the context of the case. Some are suitable sometimes, others other times. And I said that there was a second range of tests, and that is the whole biological area in relation to the DNA.
Oh, we're going to come on to DNA profiling in a moment. Presumably when you do get a match, there must be a real sense of satisfaction.
Yes, there is. You know, I mean, there's no doubt that it is. And it's a little bit like, you know, I still make jigsaws. So, you know, if two things fit together, you're feeling, yes. Mm.
Can you think of an example of a particular case where you would use forensics?
Armed robberies were a regular part of my earlier career.
Right.
I once thought that maybe armed robbers were taught they should jump up on counters because I had several cases where footprints on counters were what the evidence consisted of. There was also a tendency to wear clothing, like maybe a boiler suit or something, over regular clothing. And they might have been discarded at the scene. So there was sources of evidence in linking individuals' clothing with discarded boiler suits. Balaclavas were kind of de rigueur. And so there was the possibility of hairs in the balaclava. And then if you didn't get fibres matching the balaclava in the hair combing, that would be one that you'd kind of be a bit concerned about.
Yeah, things that are missing can be just as important as things that are present.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
yeah. It's clear that forensic methods don't just conjure up the magical right answer every time. You need to start with expectations, I guess, of what you might find.
I think that's what we're sort of probing a little bit there about the things you don't find.
Mm.
And so it's, I think, good practice to have an expectation as to what you're going to find. You can then assess your findings in light of that, as opposed to the television version is, you know, the aha moment where somebody finds the critical piece. I think the reality is it's a different process. It's think a bit about what we expect first.
But then I worry how you avoid bias. You know, if you already have preconceived expectations, how it's impossible, isn't it, to be completely unbiased?
Well, I don't think humans can be completely unbiased. One of the good ways of dealing with the bias, I think, would be to think about this aspect of probability of the evidence if this happened versus the probability of the evidence if something else happened. So that rather than just focusing on the value of the analysis of the material, you're looking at its probability in two competing hypotheses. Mm. And that, I think, helps avoid bias.
Well, you became head of chemistry at Forensic Science Ireland in 1985. But in 1986, just a year after you started, there was this rather important development in the field. DNA evidence was used for the first time in England. This must have been quite a seismic moment. Did it impact your work?
It did eventually, but I don't think I realised at the time what a big development it was. I mean, it's easy to look back and say, well, that's when the world changed in forensic science. But I don't think I realised it at the time. Actually, I remember running a small conference on behalf of the Forensic Science Society in Dublin. I think that year, a scientist talked about the first case. And there was a wow factor, but not a realisation that this would absolutely take over the field, which of course, it has been an amazing change.
OK, so here's an easy question for you, Sheila. Can you explain, as simply as possible, how DNA profiling works to help solve a crime?
Well, first of all, it's dependent on what material that you have. In the early days, there were large blood stains or semen stains. Nowadays, I'd expect to be able to get a DNA profile from the bench here just because I'm
just touching because someone's it. Touched it, right?
Yeah,
right.
And you can recover that with a piece of sticky tape. The DNA molecule is likened to a ladder which is turned to make a double helix, with sugars and phosphates making the edges of the ladder and large molecules linking like zips to make the rungs. The first thing you would have to do is extract the DNA. So you burst open the cell or lyse it, and then you release these strands that I mentioned. And then by heating them and adding a chemical, you unzip the ladder and put in chemicals that will link with one side or the other. And in that way, we have the ability. This was a big development after, I don't remember exactly what year, but Carrie Mullis got the Nobel Prize for PCR.
So that's polymerase chain reaction.
Yes. And so you replicate the
and it's just a way of making lots more of
exactly.
the same bit of DNA.
And of course, the big advantage that had was that very small samples could be worked on and give profiles later on. Whereas in the early days, it was just for very large samples that it was possible. And that lent itself to automation. And, of course, the other big advantage of this whole system was that databases were established. That means that we can store reference samples from individuals who have committed crimes and samples from scenes. So you're looking for multiple links. You're looking for either, does the scene match one of the people that you have in your database, or does the scene match another scene? So you could be providing intelligence to the police to say, OK, we're not sure who this guy is. He's not on our database, but he's been at three scenes or four scenes.
Right, right.
And I slipped into he, but actually you can tell whether it's a he or a she from the database, from the DNA. So I had the mistaken view that it wasn't a scientist's role to convince society that they should have a DNA database, because it was somewhat controversial in Ireland as to whether or not you were changing the law. You were actually forcing somebody to give evidence against themselves, if you like.
Mm.
And so for a long time, I didn't actively agitate that there was a value in having a database. And then I began to realise, you know, I mean, if the scientists don't actually say what the value is, what hope do we have?
And as you say, in Ireland, it didn't pick up DNA profiling as quickly. But when it was only really used in the highest profile cases, murders, rapes. But the more successful it became, the more demand there was for it to be used in all cases. Your workload must have gone through the roof, presumably, once this happened.
Of course it did, because we had a technology that was giving us the answer to who, which is a critical part of any investigation.
Has there been a danger that it's seen as a silver bullet, where you know, is You don't need anything else. You don't need any other supporting evidence.
I talked earlier on about the fact that the processes facilitated automation and high throughput. And that actually prompted, I think, a belief that, oh, here we have the magic answer to what we've always wanted. None of this fiddly messing around with small bits. We can put large volumes through and we'll get answers. But you've got to take the case into consideration. You've got to look at the background and see what the context is. Because sometimes the question is not who, but maybe how or when. So these are not questions that are easily answered. And if you answer the who only and mix it up with those other questions, you get a miscarriage, essentially.
Mm-hmm. There have been some high-profile cases where there has been a serious
miscarriage
of justice.
DNA has been used a lot to highlight miscarriages of justice where the evidence just didn't stand up and where DNA was valuable at showing the correct person. But if it was used incorrectly in the first instance itself, it could cause a miscarriage of justice.
Yes. So it needs to be a mix. So you've got the shiny technology that's helping the forensic scientists, but there also needs to be human judgment and reasoning.
There's a worry that people associate forensic science with linking two things, like a person via their DNA, a person via their fingerprint, or two materials. But the reality is that there's a need to reason as to whether or not these associations answer a question that's raised by the investigation. And for that reason, I think the investigator, the crime scene examiner, and the scientist need to have a shared understanding of what they're trying to address. I worked with a group of colleagues in the last couple of years on the Sydney Declaration, where we tried to put
a definition.
So this is a
report, a paper?
It's a paper. It's a published paper. And in it, we're trying to re-establish the foundations of forensic science, really, which might risk getting lost with people coming into the field who are very good from the science and technology point of view, but maybe don't have a good grounding in the broader principles.
So what's the answer then?
Scotland has gone for an integrated model where they have the entire thing from crime scene to court. And that would seem to me to be a way forward.
Well, you've certainly seen huge changes in forensic science in your time. What would you say is the next big change coming down the road for forensic science?
It's already here in the form of digital. You know, our whole world is digital nowadays. And I don't know that we're very well set up to address that.
Looking back over your career, is there one case you remember over all the others?
I remember one where I felt that I had pretty strong association with an individual.
What, that you had evidence to convict?
I thought.
Yeah.
And there was a non-guilty verdict, which maybe is an illustration of how little a part you asked earlier on about whether or not, you know, science plays too big a part. Generally, the scientists won't hear the rest of the case even, so you don't know whether how it's contributing or where it's contributing. But in that case, I felt I had pretty good evidence. And
well, you can't win them all. You're now retired, Sheila, but you do still work as a consultant and you love to keep learning. So much so that I gather you've only recently taken your university gap year. Better late than never.
I was thrilled when I retired to get an opportunity to go as a guest researcher to the US. And I had a ball. I think I got the gap year that I missed.
Usually when teenagers go on a gap year, it's because they haven't figured out what they want to do with their lives.
Well, maybe that's true for me as well. You know, I'm still trying to figure it out.
Perhaps you can come back and then tell us once you've figured out what you want to do. Sheila Willis, thank you very much for sharing your life scientific.
Thank you, Jim.
He's celebrated for things so much beyond his wrestling. The idea of being kind, compassionate, and helping others.
Mystery surrounds the death of a legendary Iranian sports star.
The state was taken aback by the breadth of segments of society that believed he had been killed by the state.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Legend of Takhti.
He was not a political figure. He just wanted to help his people.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.